us to join. But in the meantime, let's entertain ourselves with tea at the back. Please feel free. Help yourself. I'm sure in 10 minutes' time they will all be here. I really want to start, but the rules do not allow me.
Chairperson, just on a point of order, I don't think the committee needs to be a quorum in order to commence its meeting. It just needs to be a quorum in order to take decisions. And since no decisions will be taken on this item, there seems to me no reason why the meeting shouldn't commence.
Honourable members, ladies and gentlemen, I would like us to start. A copy of the agenda was circulated and it is as tabled. On item number one, I would like us to just observe a moment of silence for prayer or meditation. Thank you. Well, I'd like to welcome all of you to this meeting. A special word of welcome is extended to the CEO of Human Science Research Council and his delegation, we have guests joining us this morning. You are all welcome, and I would also like to welcome the staff. Oh, all our members, thank you very much for coming. The success of this meeting depends on your attendance. Thank you so much. Well, as we would all know, Human Science Research Council is one, we've identified it as one of our key stakeholders. And today, as we're sitting here, we will be receiving a briefing from Human Science Research Council on the 2018 Appropriation Bill. The HSRC is an important and valued partner to the Appropriation Committee as we work together to ensure that we maximize the socio-economic benefits of the scarce resources available to our people. Previous inputs from HSRC, such as setting more stringent conditions on the funding support mechanisms for SOEs, accelerating economic growth through microeconomic reforms, ensuring more support for healthcare, improving post-school education, and many others were agreed to by this committee, and recommendations in these areas were made and accepted through the adoption of our reports in the House. And they were then converted, those recommendations ended up being converted into House resolutions for implementation by the relevant departments. So I'm trying to say our engagement has enriched our thinking, has broadened the way we look at things, and has assisted in strengthening our work, our oversight work, by also ensuring that we make quality recommendations to the House. So thank you very much. So you're coming here, you see it's not... We're not taking it light. We really are taking your inputs serious. We face difficult times, and the allocation of our limited resources demands the greatest care and research-backed evidence to ensure that we approve budgets that are transformative and that improve the lives of our citizens. So with these few words, I'll once more welcome you, and please feel free. Let's make this meeting a participative meeting, and it is our meeting, and I'm looking forward to a meaningful engagement this morning. Thank you very much. Later on, it is true, this meeting will, after this briefing, this meeting will get a briefing from the DA on their inputs, also on the 2018 Appropriation Bill. So thank you very much for coming and for your inputs. We will then Yeah, move over to item number two, and which is apologies. Are there any apologies?
Yes, good morning, Chairperson, honorable members and guests. We received four apologies. The first apology is from Shopisitolia is off sick. Ms. Manana also apologized. Mr. McLaughlin is attending the Standing Committee on Auditor General. And Shoki Mum is attending the Pan African Parliament activities. Thank you.
Right, we have received these apologies. I would like to find out from the members if they accept the apology. Do we accept the apologies? At least there are reasons, and they are, to me, they are valid reasons.
Okay.
Yes. So we accept. Okay. Thank you. Any seconder? Are we seconding from the DA? Remember, it's only 1, 2, 3 members seconded. So please, as I put it earlier on, let's have a participative meeting. Thank you very much. We then move on to item number 3, which is presentation by the Human Sciences Research Council. Over to you, Say.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and can I express my appreciation to the committee for inviting us here and allowing us to talk to the budget. I'd like to also thank you, Chairperson, for explaining how the contributions that we have been making have been used. It is good for us to know that. So in the interest of time, Chairperson, and following our discussion the other day, we're going to move quite briskly through the presentation and hope that colleagues would have had an opportunity to look at it in more detail, and very happy to take any comments and questions you may wish to make. We're going to start with Professor Ivan Turok, and he will do this contextual appraisal of what the situation and the context looks like. And he's going to be followed by Professor Barbara Kanyani sitting over there, who will talk to vote four. And he will be followed by Professor Dr. Vijay Reddy and Professor Adi van Rooyen, who will talk to votes 14 and 15 on education and education and higher education. And then Professor Zuma is coming. He told us that he was at Hospital Bend, and I hope that he will get here soon. But if he doesn't arrive in time, Professor Lightness Simbaye will make his presentation. And I will conclude the presentation on votes 30, and Professor Turok will talk to vote 39 on rural development. So I'm going to hand straight over to my colleagues, please, Chairperson.
Okay, if I may just interject. I know I skipped one item, introduction. Now that I've skipped it, anyone who speaks, could you please start by introducing yourself again, so that we can then know exactly who, you know, and then I'll appreciate. Thank you so much for your understanding.
Good morning, colleagues, and thanks again for the invitation to be with you. So I'm going to start with the setting the scene very briefly, because our time is tight this morning. And then I will talk about three particular items. I'm going to talk about how cost efficiencies are pursued. I'm going to talk about growth, how to stimulate growth, and I'm going to talk about particular risks to the fiscal outlook. These are questions that were put to us in the invitation letter. So I'm not going to go through all the slides because of the time, but let me just highlight, go straight to one sort of symptom of the economic difficulties that we know we're in. So the third bullet point points to the increase in government debt from 24% of GDP nearly 10 years ago up to 53% now. So basically government is spending much more on paying back the borrowing that's had to make in order to fund public spending. And the effect of that I'm going to illustrate in a second with a slide showing how important now these debt repayments are to our budget. Okay, so unless we can strengthen the economy, get stronger growth and development. You know, we're going to continue to be saddled by this debt. And it is a big challenge in terms of spending money. You don't want to be spending money on paying back financial institutions for money you borrowed. You want to be spending it on public services. The second point I want to make is about a very sensitive issue for government, which is about public employment. So if you look at that graph on the left, you see the rapid rate at which employment in the public sector increased in the late 2000s. It's then fallen to a small extent since then, over the last 5 years or so, but that ramping up of public sector jobs, I mean, this is critically important after the global downturn, rising unemployment. Government has acted as a kind of employer of last resort. But in a context of economic difficulty, I think that does raise big questions about, is our public sector the right size? Is it fit to do the job? And in particular on the right issue of public sector wages. This is again an extremely sensitive issue, clearly it's raising debate out there among economists in the wider society about the extent to which this becomes an issue in terms of cost efficiencies in due course. Clearly very difficult issue. I'm just putting it on the agenda. The response of government to the economic difficulties have been quite mixed. I think it's fair to sum up the response in the budget. So to some extent, government responded by pushing up taxes in a modest way. VAT is the most prominent of these taxes, but there have been other small-scale increases in taxes, the sugar tax, the increase in the fuel levies and road accident levy. That's part of the response, has been to raise taxes. The second response has been to make some cutbacks in spending, at least in the planned growth in expending. And the third response has been to increase spending in particular areas, and we'll see that in a second. So it's quite a diverse response that has been taken. If we look at the balance of spending as a result of this diverse response, we see the most rapid increase in post-school education and training. This is as a response to the free fees issue, of course. The big increase in the allocation to students in higher education and vocational training, that's got a transformative objective to widen access, to improve access and enable people from poorer backgrounds to stay in higher and further education. But the contrast between that item and the near a third from bottom, basic education, is quite striking. Increasing emphasis on higher and vocational education as against basic education, I think, is beginning to raise some questions in the media about that balance. Is it appropriate? The other point I want to make about this is that second item, the debt service costs. I mentioned the increase in public sector debt, and that's now our second largest item of growth in spending. And again, I think there are question marks about the sustainability of that, about whether that's worthwhile to spend so much on debt servicing. The other items, as a context for my colleague's presentation, you could see that the increases in the core items of public spending have been broadly similar. There have been no major shifts in direction for health, social protection, community services, economic development. Those budgets have not been significantly altered. But when we come to look at the balance between spending on national, provincial, and local government, which is what this shows, let me just take your eye to that final column, and you can see the first row is national, minus 2.1, provincial, minus 1%, and then local government, minus 3.5%. You can see that local government's taken the biggest hit in terms of the spending plans over the next few years. And that's quite important given the functions of local government around basic service delivery, which we'll hear more about. And for me, it is an issue why local government has been impacted more than the other spheres of government. We were asked to talk about cost efficiencies. This is a huge issue, of course, about how best to squeeze public spending where required. I think my key point to the our key point to the committee is that actually we could do with some better evidence to inform those that question, right? And so what we're suggesting to the Standing Committee on Appropriations is to ask the public entities that report to you for more information about the criteria they use, right, to judge, to assess, to evaluate their policies and priorities. And so there are three particular questions, I think, that need to be put to them. The first one is, to what extent do they factor in the issue of economic growth and economic development into their decisions? We know they all have mandates, clear, specific mandates, but we're saying to them, we're suggesting that you say to them, in addition to that, do they explicitly consider how their expenditure could improve economic development and economic growth? The second question we suggest is, we ask them to consider explicitly and provide evidence on how their spending impacts on poverty and social protection. Do they think about that in making their plans and priorities? And thirdly, we think it's sensible to ask them, are there areas of inessential or non-priority expenditure they could identify that is not so core to their mandate that might be considered for savings? And if that information was put into the public domain through your functions as a committee, we think it would be similarly very valuable public debate, right, about the extent to which government as a whole is thinking about its impact on the economy and its thinking on poverty. And that would be a very useful function. The second point I want to make is about growth, investment, and jobs. And the question is usually put is, you know, can one offer advice about where spending is most effectively devoted to stimulating investment, stimulating jobs, stimulating economic growth. And I think the point we're making to you, that third bullet point, that perhaps the broad composition of public spending may not be the most important question. So it's very hard to say, you know, the spending on education is less significant for the economy than spending on social grants, for example, right? Because they have an effect at different points in time. They investing in the future for education is crucial, and yet social grants support a vital current maintenance, keeping people, helping people to survive in the current point in time. It's kind of hard to compare across that. So I think the next bullet point is the key one of this slide, that it's really about how these decisions are made and how priorities are selected. So that comes back to my previous point and suggestion. I think you need to scrutinize the plans of public entities and say to them, prove to us that your expenditure is helping address poverty and is helping, doing the best it can to stimulate the economy. Prove it to us. These are our fundamental objectives. How can you demonstrate that what you're doing is worthwhile? And then, so a couple of other points around this, I think. The first one is around economic infrastructure. And I think economic infrastructure is really important for long-term growth and development of the economy. And I'm raising this partly because one of the targets of the cuts in the current budget has been municipal infrastructure grants. So I think that's something that we need to think about. And in particular, when we come to that second bullet point, the balance between the maintenance and the repair of our existing infrastructure as against to investment in new infrastructure is a very, very important issue that we need to raise. Because, of course, politicians like to see new infrastructure. It's it's very good for media profile, opening new roads and so on, but we mustn't neglect, and we have had a tendency to neglect the maintenance and the repair of the existing infrastructure. So that's the second point. And then the third question is going back to my reinforcing what I said before about challenging public entities about whether economic considerations influence how they spend and how they choose priorities. And related to that is, do public entities consult other economic stakeholders when they make their plans and they make their decisions? Does ESCOM talk to the private sector? Does SANRAL talk to business? And we know that we're in an agenda where we need to engage. The president has said that. We need job summits and so on. We need much more engagement with the private sector. Well, one way you can do that is to ensure that, encourage public entities to consult more effectively with the business community. I think that would be a very useful function. On this slide, it shows how in the Treasury have made some sort of rough and ready estimates of how different kinds of reforms flagged up in the NDP might impact on GDP growth. I just want to flag the one in the middle, right in the middle, because they're basically arguing that if we encourage new business formation, right, we know that our economy is quite concentrated. We have big, strong companies that kind of exclude new entrants and new businesses from starting. And that is a problem in terms of competition. It's a problem in terms of growth. Well, I think this is another really interesting and important priority emerging around encouraging business formation, encouraging, helping people to start businesses, ensuring there's a level playing field and they're not forced and excluded, constrained from growing by the operations, the actions of our big, powerful companies. So that seems to me to be worth putting on the table. And then my final slide before handing over to my colleagues. We were asked to say something about risks to the fiscal outlook. And you yourselves, honourable members, have raised the issue of state entities. And we are just retaining that on, keeping that on the table. It's a big issue, of course. Our state entities needing more resources, needing more borrowing. It's not going to go away in a hurry. We know that there are significant difficulties facing many of our key state entities. Higher education also, I've already flagged up how the funding of higher education now has become the biggest growing item and is clearly a big challenge going forward as the free fees is rolled out beyond first year to second and third year students, increasing the cost of that. The third item I've also flagged, the public sector salaries. What I particularly want to draw attention to here is the balance between frontline staff and so-called backroom staff. I think it's another good question to put to government departments and state entities, the extent to which they're protecting the jobs of frontline staff, which really count most, which is where, you know, citizens are most concerned about public services, as against administrative functions. And maybe there's scope to achieve savings around the bureaucracy, perhaps using new technology to streamline administrative systems and to enable those critical frontline staff to be protected. And the final item I want to highlight is around special zones and strategic projects. We're seeing quite a proliferation of special zones in the last few years. The agri-zones, the revitalization of industrial estates in the former homelands and all over rural South Africa. There is a question about whether these projects are being planned in a coordinated way. There is a big question about whether the relevant departments are learning and thinking strategically about this, not just throwing money at what could be white elephants in the future. Thanks very much. My time's up.
Thank you, Professor, and then over to you.
Thank you. I'll be speaking very briefly on vote 4, especially where Professor Turok has stopped, especially on the local government, where he made a very strong input about the situation on the fiscal. The critical issue.
I'm sorry if I may interject. I would like to welcome all the members that have joined us. Thank you very much for coming. But also, say if you could introduce yourself. If you could introduce yourself so that we can know who's speaking to us now. Thank you.
All right. My name is Mudimu Awarwa Kanyani.
And your role?
And my role, I'm in the program called Governance Service Delivery.
Okay. Thank you very much. You may proceed.
Thank you. I think, as I've alluded before, I'll be speaking briefly on matters of local government, where Ivan, my colleague, have stopped, especially on the vote for. When you look at the national context, I think the critical areas where we normally find a challenge, which I think priority in terms of our preparation to be given attention, is the relationship between local government or municipalities and traditional leaders. And we know that we have institutionalized framework, you know, House of Traditional Leaders and also local government machinery. But what we realize often is that the relationship is not getting better, it's getting worse, because the service delivery get affected when the two structures, local government and traditional leadership authorities, are in a conundrum. So the case in point could be the example of the Royal Bafokeng Nation with the Rustenburg local municipality, where we find that the duplication of services which have been provided, and I think that need to be customized in one or the other. But that cut across a situation where we find that in rural communities, where this vote for is that 16 million citizens in rural traditional communities are living in low economic areas, and some of these challenges really is because of the efficiencies that are taking place there. I want to go to the next slide, which talk about the institutional context. And I think more resources need to be allocated to the traditional leaders so that they should be fully empowered about their role that they conduct. And often at times, you'll find that they don't have an evidence-based policy that is informed by a robust research so that they can able to execute their responsibilities. So therefore, there's a need to reprioritize some of these appropriations to allow more funding to execute and apply the research for a transformative governance and developmental local government. And the last slide, which I want to focus on, is I take it as a risk, you know, assessment area. And most of us, we are so much equivalent, exposed to the role of the Municipal Demarcation Board, which often at times when they are doing their demarcations, it triggers protest. A case in point is the Vuani matter, which attracted about 240 million damages when decisions have been made. So the question is that we need to find a way, because we also see in this vote that the allocation is not even there, that they need to have enough funding so that they can conduct research, and their decision must be informed by robust research, but to also provide an appeal mechanism so that the community would have a more social responsibility, unlike running to the court, and when they are frustrated, then they burn the buildings. So the decisions, this is a risk factor, where you are saying that given the need for review of some of the legislation to ensure that they execute its mandate sufficiently and to allow more social responsibility, will require more funding mechanism to be introduced.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I must recognize the presence of the chief whip just for my guests. Otherwise, the other members know that we're very fortunate to have the chief whip sitting here. So we better present our best conduct. But thank you very much. Next.
Thank you very much, Vijay Reddy from Education. Now that you've said that, I might have to change my slides. because the education budget and the allocation of funding of the education funds has been controversial, and it has raised many questions. I want to speak directly to the third point, the third bullet in the letter, Chair, of research and evidence-based assessment with regards to possible institutional arrangements that can stimulate cost efficiencies. And the argument that I want to set up is that where will the funding and investments be the best cost efficiency for education? Is it to set up solid educational foundations and investments in the earlier years, or do we play catch-up later, and when do we stop saying, or the institutions higher up say, well, they didn't have enough basic education? So I want to use this opportunity in analysis of the budget to try to make that argument. And in making that argument, of course, it is that the incontrovertible fact of that the priority for education. And so we'll highlight the education budget, both the 14 and basic education and the higher education budget, and we'll look at it in terms of looking at trends and efficiencies. And let me put up front what we propose, that we think that for the best in education, we need to focus on the first 5 years of schooling, or since health has the first 100 days of a child's life for health, we're saying a 1,000 days of a child's life, we're saying the first 1,000 days of schooling. In other words, most efficiency in education, investments in grade R, 1, 2, and 3. And so that's the argument that we want to make through this. This will be a duet, and I'll present part of it, and Professor Van Rooyen the other part of it. Of course, this is known of the analysis of the 1.6 trillion rand budget, and basic education takes up 15% of that budget, and PSET, the post-school education and training budget, is around 5%. Now, of this budget, the part of the analysis is that 77% of the basic education budget goes to salaries. Ivan talked about the compensation for people that are working in there, which means that there is now 23% for the operations of schooling, of textbooks, of toilets, etc. And I thought, before making a judgment about that, because how do you say whether 77% is good or bad? And a slide that I didn't include, but it is the OECD study which looks at compensation of staff in public educational institutions for various countries. And South Africa is not the one with the highest compensation for their staff. In fact, Portugal, Mexico, Argentina have just about 3% for their operational budget, and countries like Hungary, Finland, Czech Republic, Slovak Republic, etc., have much less proportion for the salaries budget. And it's something that it's a dilemma that one needs to be constantly balancing in. It's important, again, to look at the government expenditure in relation to trends. Again, the trend for all the social services of health, social development, is all increasing. And again, as Ivan had pointed out, that the increase for the... I can't get this thing to work, the pointer. That the biggest jump has been for higher education, but of course the total budget for basic education is much higher, and this is the health department. And so the spending on basic education has increased slightly, and the spending on the PSET sector has increased much more. Again, to try to use some of the international indicators for understanding the budget on education, in 2008, we spent 4.87% of GDP and 18% of the total government expenditure on education. In 2018, we're spending 6.7% of the GDP on education and one-fifth of the total expenditure in education. Again, to understand it, we thought it's better to look at it in relation to other countries, because then only one can make a sort of comparison. And what happened here? Something happened with the slide here that didn't pick up the countries. Sorry about that. I think something on... Something that we're, I hope that your points have got it correct there. So the one on the extreme left is India, which spends 3.8% of the budget on of GDP. The one immediately next to India is Malaysia, 4.9%. The one on the extreme right, the one with the highest percent, is 7.2% is for Botswana. And South Africa, the one with the green dot there, South Africa spends 5.9%. So it's quite interesting to see that India's expenditure of GDP on budget is 3.8%, because, and in Malaysia 4.9%, but Botswana, our neighbor, which is a much smaller system, is 7.2%. So I don't know what happened there. Just looking at the, and very quickly on this slide, we tried to analyze the budget expenditure outcomes, both in terms of the national department and the provinces and the percentages. And the next bit, it gives us, if we want to look at and try to make comparison, it's the total number of learners and the size of the system. And of course, the in general, there isn't a big difference in the cost of spending per learner in each of the province. And we thought we'd look at what the trends in terms of achievements are, but there isn't a direct link in terms of how the provincial achievements go. We will leave that for your reading. And so overall our assessment is that in terms of education, there has been improvement, but the pace of it is far too slow in terms of how to for what we need in the country. And so the big question is then to ask, what are the leverage points in order to improve investments? I'm not going to look at infrastructure of time. Now, in terms of our argument of the investments in education for the best efficiencies, if we look at the literature throughout, our literature tells us that the focus, it points to the investments in higher, in early education. And so if you look on that scale, for 5-year-olds, we have the achievement scores of the children in terms of how they at different quartiles. And you will see that throughout, whatever you get in your achievement at 5 or 6 years, it predicts what's going to be your achievement further on. It will predict your labor market outcomes. It predicts your social income outcomes. And so the investment in the first 5 years, the earlier years, is critical for everything else. I'm not going to go through that. It's also important to know that if we look at the children aged 0 to 4, about 50% of them are at home and about 50% are attending some sort of educational institution. And again, our proposals are, while we have the grade R associated with institutions for grade R is now part of many of the educational institutions. Like the NDP proposes 2 years of pre-grade one. We're proposing that we need to take that very seriously, and especially for no-fee schools, that within those institutions there should be the both grade R and grade RR, so that the stimulation early on will give those learners a better chance in the system. And again, in the analysis, the budget is absolutely silent on funding grade R and grade RR. And yet, this is the most important bit for any kinds of improvement. And so in terms of our institutional arrangements, we think that this is where we need to focus. The first 1,000 days of schooling and should be prioritized. I'm just going to ask Prof. Van Rooyen to speak before we come to the higher education.
Yes, okay. Good morning, everyone. So we're Sister Sledge. I'm Sister, she's a Sledge. And my name is Heidi Van Rooyen from the HSRC. And I'm going to just amplify, I think, some of the points Dr. Reddy has been making, particularly around this context and the importance of early childhood development. The HSRC has been leading, providing a lot of leadership and support around the importance of this issue, particularly around the development of the early child development policy, development of an investment plan, and modeling and implementation plans. And I think large gains have been made, but I think, again, Dr. Reddy has really emphasized the importance of us kind of really revisiting this attention we give to children in that early preschool stage. And I think the number of challenges which remain, which we want to just highlight this morning. Can you just move the slide, please? And so these are some of the key challenges we think we should be focusing on that will help us avoid several threats to the success of this early childhood development policy that we are rolling out. I think, again, emphasizing programming for the first 1,000 days, and that this needs to be focused and family-centered. It really needs to address the needs of high-risk families. We have to look at the issue of maternal mental health and its effect on childhood development, and we must look at the issues of child growth and development, issues of food security, overweight, and obesity and stunting, and I want to talk a little about that now. Next slide, please. So we did a really important piece of work which showed us and really emphasized that almost 0.5% of households are faced with food shortage problems in our area of KwaZulu-Natal. Often in these families and many families around the country, food is frequently unavailable, and when it is, often it's starchy carbohydrates and fats that are high in energy and low in nutrition. And these have really severe implications for the rates of obesity we've seen in children in that 7 to 10, next slide please, Vijay, the 7 to 10 age graph. Body mass index, which is an indicator of obesity, really shows us that many of those kids, 95% of those kids in that 7 to 10-year-old age category are actually obese or overweight. So a really serious problem, this issue of nutrition and food security in many of our households. Next slide, please. Stunting is also a problem, again, in that particular age category. Almost just under a quarter of kids, 10-year-old boys, for example, are stunted. Next slide, please, Vijay. And so this has really serious implications, this issue of childhood overweight and obesity. And the real important message you want to take away is if we don't address these issues earlier on, they have serious implications for children later on, because these issues and these diseases and conditions only become apparent in adulthood, leading to issues like cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and certain types of cancer. Chronic malnutrition, which is really causes stunting, is devastating to young children and it results in a number of ill effects, brain development, impaired brain development, lower IQ, and so on. So really strong case and argument that we're wanting to make, next slide please, Vijay, that we really have to address this early on in this first 1,000 days. Look at our primary health care facilities, make sure that we are providing both health, weight, and height measurements, and we're monitoring these, that we're looking at in the context of families, for parents and for caregivers, issues around nutrition and physical activity to support much more healthier outcomes for these children later on. Next slide, please, Vijay. And that's over to you, and then I'll come back at the end.
Yes, I think if we haven't made it clear, the bottom line is that, you know, when we talk about it, how do we get all our 4- and 5-year-olds? We hope that we don't have to get the 4- and 5-year-olds out in the street in order to try and demand funding for their part of it, and rather we hope this engagement will be helpful. And so in terms of the analysis of vote 15 there, and it is quite surprising to when you the analysis of government training and higher education and training expenditure, this is without the National Skills Fund, that there's an increase in funding towards universities, and Ivan also pointed this, but 81% of government funding on the PSET vote goes to the university budget, and 14.7% in 2018 goes to the TVET sector. Now, of course, if one looks at the growth of the economy and skills for the economy, the skills needed are largely the intermediate kind of skills which are produced at the TVET colleges, but that kind of funding proportion is much lower. The good news on this slide is to see that from 2016 that there's been an increasing budget for the community education, those that are attending community colleges and community education, which is again provides access to a larger number. But the university sector budget bears a question. I'm not going to look at it because things that you know there. We have completed, Dr. Vilskut in the HSRC completed a study looking at all the NISFAS recipients from 2005 and to 2015. And 2 points that we'd like to make from this. Firstly, over that period, there were close to 612,000 recipients of the NISFAS funding, and of that, 278,000 graduate. In a crude way, this is 42% of those that received the funding eventually graduated. And what is pleasing to note, of those that graduated, most of them found employment. But the worrying slide is this one. If you look at the of those 612,000, just 200,000 had the grant for 1 year. So one assumes that having the grant for 1 year, that they might have left the system thereafter. And 145,000 for 2 years. And there are people that received the grant for 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 15 years. So one really needs to look at the kinds of NISFAS systems and how is it that somebody could continue to get a grant for this period of time. And so these are part of the efficiencies. But let me go to
you. So back to me, and I think just next slide, please. I think the real issue we're wanting to kind of supplement what Dr. Reddy has been saying is around this issue of context. And I think in some of some of the things we want to say is that just to comment on the low completion rates of many of our students on time, only 1 in 4 are kind of completing on time. We note a particular trend, white completion rates are higher than black students. And we note again, as we've all been talking about this morning, the inequity in enrollment rates. And I think the big point we're wanting to emphasize is that fee-free education really only fixes this last figure, this inequity in enrollment rates. But we really want to just talk a little bit about how do we address some of those other issues and points 1 to 3. Next slide, please. We did a study, a really important study, following 80 students in 8 universities over 5 years. And I think it's really provided with us some very useful outputs, which are indicated on the slide, but also highlighted an important issue around the struggles and obstacles and possible strategies and resources that we think are needed for addressing this issue in higher education. Next slide, please. This gives you a sense of just really the kind of struggles that university students are talking about, and the extreme left, finance, racism, language, mental health issues, sexual violence, safety, sexual identity crises, and so on. Few women in leadership, fears of inferiority, so many real issues that young people are facing beyond just the issue of fees. And on the right-hand side, we indicate possible ways or responses that we could put in place to try and, responses to some of those struggles that students are facing. Next slide, please, Vijay. I think we just really want to make just some key recommendations based on our work with these 8 universities and with these young people and really their voice in putting forward some of the struggles and issues that they face in navigating a tertiary education. I think the importance of student-learner dialogues, of talking to students about where they're at and what they need, will help us with them find some creative solutions to the issues that they're facing. The usefulness of mentoring and accountability strategies, the need to really upgrade orientation processes to make it compulsory, to provide 2 opportunities in a year where this could be done, and to focus on issues of equity and self-guided learning. We really want to think about and provide young students with some strategies to make psychosocial and writing computing services accessible. A lot of young people enter university systems without having proper kind of grounding, training, and exposure to many of these things. I think that's all I want to highlight there, and I think we want to hand over to Mr. Zuma, who, Prof. Zuma, has arrived. Over to you, Kangalani.
Thank you very much, Kalik. Yes, I'm Kangalani Zuma. I'm an executive director at HSRC in the HAST unit, HIV, AIDS, STIs, and TB research program. I'm going to look at the issues around health, which includes HIV, TB, and other non-communicable diseases. One of the things that I just want us to reflect on is the situation that we face as a country, that South Africa has the largest number of people who are living with the HIV, and those statistics, I have to say, we expect them that they will increase. One of the reasons it's a good one in the sense that people are living longer because they've got access to antiretroviral treatment. But one of the bad reasons is that the incidence, which is the rate at which people get infected with HIV, is still above 1%, which is still contributing to increasing the HIV epidemic. But of course, as a research institution, we still continue to conduct research around that area. For example, we're busy with a study that is targeting about 60,000 people to look at HIV and many other issues, which is a population-based HIV survey, and also another big study that we're doing, which is a TB prevalence survey, which is the first study to be done in the country, even though TB is actually one of the number one cause of death in the country, but it's the first study to be done in the country to look at TB prevalence and any other issues related to TB. However, be that as it may, we must commend what the government has done to contribute about 80% of funding or contribution to deal with HIV epidemic actually comes from the government. However, if we are to win this epidemic and many other epidemics that we live with, we need to up our game, we need to increase funding, we need to increase contribution to institutions and also to look at these health issues that our society faces, especially given the fact that the donor funding that we so heavily rely on is actually dwindling as we speak. Now, the other issues, I've spoken about HIV and TB just as highlight, but there are many other ailments that we face. For example, non-communicable diseases, they continue to be one of our big challenges, especially, for example, diabetics is listed as one of our number, it features in the top five killers in South Africa. So, and also there is very limited comprehensive and systematic data on cost and economic impact of these non-communicable diseases in South Africa. So there is a need to collect this information together with the burden of disease that is due to these NCDs to develop an investment case around NCDs. So there is still a lot that we need to really look at to understand the impact of these NCDs. Now, looking at the budget, of course, when you look at the numbers, clearly you can see that the total allocation to health is highly concentrated on goal 3, on program 3 and program 5, which actually take about 91% of the budget. And if you look at the overall increase over the years, actually it's easy to see that this has been a modest increase, especially if you take away the inflationary issues as well as other tax increases that are involved there. Now, it should also be noticed that, of course, other programs have received a big year-on-year increase. One of them is Program 2, which has received on average a 46% year-on-year increase. Now, just some observations that we make is one wonders whether actually is the funding for free higher education crowding out some of the necessary public expenditure on the implementation of, for example, national health insurance and re-engineering of primary health care. And this question is very critical given the lack of clarity on what has been allocated, for example, in areas such as tobacco control and also the silence in the budget around non-communicable disease programs. Now, there are a number of dimensions that one would notice around healthcare, so that promoting health equity is essential to achieving the third sustainable development goal, one of the sustainable development goals. And in our situation, we've got the National Development Plan, which aims to reduce inequalities in health. The study of health inequalities needs to take a broad view of inequality in access to healthcare, including historic and current disadvantages that are extending beyond utilization, and incorporating a study of inequalities in whole health, in the whole health and care-seeking experience, which is inclusive of any other disparities, both in demand for healthcare and also on the supply side for healthcare. Now, what we've looked For example, just to understand the inequalities around health, one of the index that is used and will show some results to understand the health is the concentration index, which is a well-established metric which actually looks at categorizes or presents statistics from numbers minus one, which takes the values minus one to positive one, whereby a higher negative value, it actually means that particular measure that you're looking at is more common, more prevalent among the poor, whilst the positive, it means that whichever we're looking at is more common among those that are more affluent, and the zero means there's like equality in how that is distributed in the society. Now, looking at the numbers based on this health index, one can see that in terms of health need, the prevalence of need is greater among the poor than the rich. Those perceiving a need for care, moreover, do not necessarily access care. So they need care, but they can't have access to care. The poor are more likely to have postponed seeking medical care or to have not received care. And that is more tragic, especially when you look at the issues around HIV, where the impact of other STIs have got a very serious effect on the incidence of HIV that we've been talking about, and all other illnesses around that. People that cannot access care, who need care, it's a big challenge. So, and also as expected, problems with ability to pay for care and medicine is also more pronounced among poor people. So health needs to also be seen as an investment in the same way that we try to do with education. Now, there are a number of studies that have been done. For example, one of our big studies that we do annually, the South African Social Attitude Survey, has actually shown in a number of ways that poor people report that their healthcare needs are not adequately met compared to those that are more affluent. Now, the next two slides, we can move on. They still emphasize the issues of health and the inequalities. So we can move on to the next observation. Another observation that we made also is that health inequality in South Africa, therefore, it remains stuck and it is extensive. Ultimately, inequalities in health and healthcare faced by poor are compounded as one moves across the various dimensions of access to healthcare. And the poor are at a disadvantage across the continuum of access to health, from healthcare needs and also to healthcare-seeking behavior. So they are at a disadvantage in this case, because they also cannot afford the cost of health care. Now, government has implemented a number of important programs around health care in the last few years, and it is imperative that adequate funding be invested in extensive prospective evaluations of these studies, not only just small-scale studies that look at what has been done, but any bigger studies that look at evaluating what we have seen, and also so that we can plan for the future. So how do we achieve this? Well, achieving the goal of, for example, one of the goals, which is universal health care, requires these statistics around health care, and we need to track to have data sources that we can use to actually track this information. So larger allocations, for example, to institutions such as HSRC, MRC, and the Health Systems Trust that look at this information and analyze this data could help us achieve these goals. And also making sure that we contribute, for example, in other studies that I've mentioned, which is the South African Social Attitude Survey. Let's have modules. We do it every year. Let's have modules that talk about health issues, and so we can understand the issues around health. And also one of another studies that we can use to get this information is a follow-up study on the South African National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, which also can be used to provide a barometer against which we can compare whatever results that we get with the first ever survey that was done to understand the impact also of other non-communicable diseases. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. So I'm Crane Sodin, and I'm the CEO of the HSRC. So I'm going to be talking to Vote 30 Very quickly, Chairperson. I'm going to take the slides as read and ask you to go to slide number 67, which makes the point about the significance of developing capacity in science and technology in the country. And we simply are wanting to alert colleagues to just the issues which arise out of making sense of what the profile of our science technology community might look like, and say to you that, as the slide reflects, there are a large number of our researchers in the country who are not South Africans. So we want to be hospitable to non-South Africans, but there clearly is an issue here in building the capacity of South Africans themselves to be able to operate in this space. And in terms of that, and this is the last slide under this vote that I'd like to talk to, is to say that we have a challenge here in thinking systemically across the national system of innovation. We're in the closing stages of developing a white paper in all of this, and the issue in that white paper is clearly coordination. So we need to be thinking about how that coordination happens across the sector and across the system, between universities, councils, and national facilities, but also critically how we build relationships between the public sector, the publicly funded sector, and the private sector. So there are big issues here, and they relate, of course, to our own home department, the DST. The HSRC is in the DST, and we are a direct, if you like, entity impacted on how these decisions are made, and we can feel the impact of those decisions. Thanks very much, Chairperson. I'd like to ask Professor Turok to close off for us, please.
Thanks very much. I just want to make two points on the rural development vote. The first point is on this slide towards the bottom. Basically, the budget spend for land reform is very modest, considering that this is an issue that is of such political significance. So it's modest, the budget, and the department concerned has been underspending, has not been spending its budget. So there are big issues about the performance here of the public sector at delivering on this important, highly politicized issue. The second issue I want to raise is around the use of land. All right, so the key issue is not simply to transfer ownership, to redistribute, to redress, and reform around land, but is to ensure that it is productive. And so this is the sort of issue of rural development in the title of the department, and not simply land reform. And this, again, is an area where I think our research, my colleagues, demonstrates that there is unsatisfactory performance around ensuring productive use of land that is transferred to beneficiaries. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. That concludes our presentation.
Well, Prof and your team, I must thank you for the elaborate, insightful, and informative presentation from all the presenters. Thank you very much. And honorable members were listening carefully. I am now going to open the floor for clarity-seeking questions. This is information that we have asked so that we can be in a better position, or from an informed position, are able to consider the appropriations bill and make recommendations to the House on areas of improvement, and we take it from there. An exercise that will be followed by oversight on a quarterly basis on the spending of the budget of the national budget. Thank you very much. Over to you, honorable members. Honorable Member Gcwabaza, Honorable Member Tuesday. Got it right. Honorable Member Meinier and Honorable Member Snugwanyana, Honorable Member Memela, in that order.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. May I go to slide 4? The second last bullet. There has been a concerted effort in recent weeks to attract foreign direct investment from the highest office in the land, which is a very commendable. However, I want to come back to the domestic investment and ask you, what is your view with regard to efforts to urge those with financial muscle to also improve their effort to invest in the domestic economy. I've heard that economists will say foreign direct investment will only come if they see domestic investors being actively involved themselves in investing in their own economy. Otherwise, they begin to ask questions as to why should we go and invest there when what is there that the domestic business are aware of, that we are not aware of, that makes them not to invest. Let me go to slide 6. Again, a lot has been said about business confidence and lately consumer confidence beginning to be on the rise in the country. Because of new hope, political hope that is coming through now. And of course, the assumption is that that would assist the economy to take a turnaround, as projections are beginning to show now. That alone, though, is no. There's no proof that that indeed, let me put it this way, it does call for us to do more than just depending on consumer and business confidence. What else do we need to do very urgently as a country? On slide 10, I hope, Chairperson, you... should I... Three questions.
Yes. Okay. A maximum of three questions.
Okay, we'll come back.
And then I'll give you another chance, you know, for a second bite.
Okay. Let me ask you my third and last question. On slide 10, bullet 3, it's sometimes said that if government spends, that would encourage the private sector as well to come into the party. And you make an interesting point there, that government public spending may not necessarily be one of the main factors that determines economic growth. What then are you suggesting needs to be done in addition to government spending? We have been talking about public-private partnerships in growing the economy for a good couple of years now. Are we on the right track? Are we doing the right things? Or are we sitting back and depending on public spending only to stimulate the economy? Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Rosa, for the questions next. I think it's Honorable Member Duaste.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. I would just like a question, it's more a question of clarity on non-communicable diseases. A while ago, I made a statement that it is one of the leading causes of death amongst women because their own diets really lack nutritional value, and it's reflected in the high levels of obesity amongst women. I think it's estimated at around 70%. But then it was said to me that no, I'm not correct. HIV AIDS still remains the leading cause of death, and that non-communicable diseases really is kind of not an important issue. So I would like to understand, you know, the relationship between non-communicable diseases and HIV/AIDS, and which really are both leading causes, or is the one more important than the other one? The second issue I want to just add some clarity on or raise is about the first 1,000 days. I mean, it's an issue that I feel very passionate about and that I support, and I mean the literature is full of emphasizing the first 1,000 days, but which stretches from conception to the age of 2, and how important it is to address the developmental needs of children during that stage. So I was quite surprised to hear about the first 1,000 days of school, and I just wanted to know whether that is that more kind of an indirect way of kind of manipulating government to moving back towards the first 1,000 days, or whether that is actually is something that is backed up by research. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. I hate to burst the bubble, but frankly, I mean, based on the quality of the presentation that we've seen today, frankly, I mean, when we're looking for savings next year in the budget, I think we should consider closing down the HSRC. I mean, what we've got here today is, frankly, a weak presentation with purloined statements, purloined data and graphs from the National Treasury, some recycled data, some interesting data presumably based on the HSRC's research. But then frankly, slide after slide with good, interesting questions, this is a big issue, this is a huge issue, questions need to be asked, there's no evidence, we need further evidence, we need a public debate. Frankly, this is the HSRC. We don't need the questions, we need the answers. And we need concrete proposals on the implications for the budget and concrete proposals on how the budget should be amended. Frankly, this presentation is amateur hour, and I think we should look at frankly shutting down the HSRC. It's an utter waste of time.
Okay, you have put your opinion across. Shall we then take the other hand? Yes, this is your thinking.
Honorable Meli is known for drama. That's what he's doing.
Okay, I'd like to control it in this manner to say he presented his opinion. You must remember everybody has an opinion. And I'm told people are allowed to express their opinions. But then let's hear other people's interrogation of the presentation. Because we can look at the same issue, but from different angles. It's Honourable Member Snukwanyane and then yourself, say. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. And thank you very much, HSRC, for your presentation. My first question, perhaps of clarity, is in terms of the nominal spending growth. That's a slide.
Please, yeah.
Oh, sorry. Issue of spending growth, where you refer to the debt servicing and the concern around the debt service costs, which are high, and what would be your proposal if perhaps, like, for instance, you are saying, Mr. Turok, that obviously the percentage is quite high, I agree with that, but is there any suggestion that you would be able to make to say, in terms of this debt servicing, what would you propose that we do in there? And in the same, within the same slides, I'm just talking to that slide that also you mentioned the fact that the post-school education and training getting such a huge chunk could compromise the basic education. I'm just trying to think that basic education, this budget has always been there. There has always been a budget allocation for basic education. And this fee-free higher education is a new baby, and I think it's bound to be allocated much more. And we all know the university fees, everything around tertiary education has always been expensive, which is why many poor students have not been able to access it. So I'm not necessarily arguing for it, for correctness of the budget, but don't you think it is because of the fact that it's expensive anyway at the moment, which is why, and it is a first of its kind, that it is being funded. And also on the same page, you spoke about, I didn't quite get what you were saying about the reduction in the local government allocation, because it is a conditional grant. That's been reduced, and all the conditional grants actually across the budget have been reduced. So that was one. And then in terms of education and the budget for compensation of employees, what would be your take then? Because I know that in education, most of the budget will go to teachers and you name it. But you did also make examples of other countries that maybe if you can just speak to that how do they do that? Because with us also, we don't have technology. We use warm bodies to do most of the things at school. But I haven't done the research. I wouldn't have a good argument. And maybe my third one would be, I just want to choose one. Okay. The NHI versus tertiary again, or primary health care versus tertiary. You know, the problem that we sit with right now is that tertiary health services are very expensive as we sit, besides talking about the budget. They cost the government a huge amount of money, and unfortunately we are not, perhaps we are failing to implement adequate primary health care which is related to the NHI, and I imagine that this is one of the reasons why maybe we would need to maybe then look at how we can actually work around the tertiary services, because our patients as well are very difficult. They don't like going to primary health care services, even without the NHI being properly established at the moment, because it isn't just as yet. It's just our old primary health care that we have. I will stop the chair for now.
Thank you. Honorable Member Memela, and then after. Okay, after. All right. Over to you, sir.
Yeah, I'm gone. Thank you, Honorable Chair. Mine relates to, slide number 49, that deals with HIV and TB. That I want to know as to whether does this slide include the mining communities, or is only focusing on some of the populations of South Africa? Does it include the mining communities? Because also, they are part and parcel of the issues we are raising here. Suffice to say, the TB, there is a disease called silicosis, the lung diseases. Have you ever checked as to whether are also part and parcel of the slides we are referring to here? The other one, Chair, relay this page, slide 44, on higher education. There is a sentence here in black. It's written, if you are black and poor, you are in trouble. This place is very brutal for black poor kids. Can you unpack this statement? Because there is a if a Chinese is born here in South Africa, born here, is it part and parcel of a black, or how do you classify a Chinese who was born and bred here in South Africa after 1994? Where do you classify him or her? Is it a black or a Chinese? The other one, Chair, relates to slide 37. You made mention of some challenges that you are faced with, and some recommendations. You don't tell us about the achievables. Is there any realizable program in place that can be proud of to say, yes, indeed, even if we have these challenges, but these are some of the things that are achievable? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Member, for your contribution. Honorable Member Memela. Thank you, Chair. I am worried about the report of the HSRC around the preschool, especially rural areas. I wouldn't know how true is your report unless you actually tell us which rural areas have you gone to. And I'm saying that because we've done quite a lot of oversight. And preschool issues are close to my heart.
because it's true. Seated here, we know very well traditional leaders are involved in those areas. So we need more research. And it's not the first time I'm actually coming up with that. Two, there was this reference to fat kids and things like that. Is it based on poor nutrition, or that's the end reasons for other factors that are around those kids? Bearing in mind that rural areas depend on using the soil, growing their food. And that is why I'm bringing it up. I'm not satisfied with the report. And when you talk of rural areas, it's us. It's our families. And we know what is happening there. So can you please do thorough research around those issues? I'll be happy about that. And when it comes to HIV and AIDS,
I do apologize.
Okay. There's mother-to-child transmission, which is the worst blow. So you people seated here should have a broader area to investigate. And those rural areas, the clinics are miles away from the residents. So they need more, help, because before there was those local clinics on wheels, not buildings, to make sure they can actually reach those poor people. They move to the far rural areas, because otherwise those people have to sit in clinics for hours on end. What about the other children left at home? You other researchers, and I'm pleading with you, go deeper into those areas I'm talking about and give us a truthful report. It's urgent.
Thank you for all the questions. I will now ask Prof and your team to respond to the issues raised by the Honourable Member.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm going to ask my colleagues who led the presentations in these particular areas to take them up. I would simply like to respond to, first of all, Mr. Meunier, and say to him, Honourable Minister, Mr. Meunier, I'm sorry that you think that we should be closed down. I'm sorry that you should be putting an opinion like that in a space like this, in a way which is so important in terms of appropriations. I'm sorry that we haven't had the opportunity to be able to tell you what we do. We'd be very happy to do that. We'd be very happy to take the time and come to explain to you what this organization is all about, what the significance of it is for the country. I'm very happy to talk with you. I'd like to ask Ivan to lead us off, please.
Thanks very much. Let me take first the first three questions around investment, domestic investment, how to turn around and stimulate growth, and public-private partnerships. I think at the heart of them, they're actually the same question, because getting more business investment is fundamental. Domestic investment is fundamental to growth, to development, to the taxes. That was another question, to raising, generating the taxes to fund public services and to reduce the borrowing costs. Now, of course, this is a very, very difficult question, okay? And I think many of the challenges that are facing the country are not, the answers are not straightforward in response to that earlier comment. The responses are not, it's not as if the evidence immediately tells you what the solution is. These are hugely disputed issues around getting the economy growing. Economists disagree widely, right, across, there's a whole spectrum of responses around what should be done. So in my view, there are three elements of the answer. The first one is a greater political stability. I think there's no doubt that when the finance ministers are reshuffled at short notice, that this creates enormous volatility and uncertainty across the country as a whole, among consumers, among businesses, among foreign investors. They simply don't know what's going on when an apparently steady, stable, reliable Minister of Finance is suddenly fired. That raises alarm bells in a big way. So I think the new environment of stability, of a steady hand, a trusted leadership is regarded as is a necessary precondition. It's generally one of the conditions, and that's, of course, the challenge of the new environment. But I think that symbolizes actually a willingness to engage with the business community is also really important in that. Rather than a hostile, there has been sometimes a hostile view of the private sector, perhaps summarized by a sort of white monopoly capital kind of language that does not suggest a recognition that business is one of the key stakeholders in our society and needs to be engaged with actively. So that's the first point, a political predictability and some sense of stability. The second one is around red tape, because I think there is a lot of evidence that our regulatory burdens have been increasing over the years. Each one is legitimate, has a good case to be made. Take the environment, for example. Take water scarcity. You know, we face massive challenges around the environment, so it's quite reasonable for each of these systems of regulation to be introduced. The problem has been they've been introduced kind of independently, right, with nobody looking at the big picture of what these things amount to and what they cumulatively result in terms of obstacles to barriers to business investment. So I think the time has come for a kind of strategic, a synoptic view of what these regulatory burdens amount to and whether they are reasonable or unreasonable. And in some cases, it's possible to streamline some of these procedures and to synchronize. So I'll give you an example from my own research. We have three parallel processes of public participation before development hits the ground: environmental regulations, water use licenses, and building and planning controls. Those three systems, for any new development, a new housing project, there has to be three systems of public participation. Communities have to be consulted separately about the approval procedures in those cases. We could easily consolidate them into a single process where the public was consulted once. The public only wants to be consulted once about the same project. It doesn't want to be consulted about separate things in silos. Okay, so there are ways of simplifying, streamlining red tape. The final point is around real dialogue and engagement between government and business community. You talked about partnership, real partnership, listening, engaging, negotiating. In some cases, there are really hard negotiations that have to take place with concessions on both sides and involving the unions too in this dialogue. There has to be serious. So the summits are a great starting point that have been talked about, but they need to be followed through with serious behind-the-scenes deal-making to listen to what businesses' concerns are and to meet halfway or some way to address these issues of regulation, these issues of wages, the issues of the risks that business faces and is concerned about. And they will vary in different sectors. The mining charter was well known, been flagged as a key issue. Each sector has its own set of issues where serious negotiation needs to take place between the three parties. That seems to me to be critical. The last question I want to address is about debt servicing, how to cut it. And the problem has been you can't cut your debt obligations unless you are going to cause serious disruption to international financiers. The way to do it is to grow the economy, to generate the taxes, so there's less need to borrow. That is a sort of short answer to it. If we can get growth growing quickly, then that will help to bring this down. Thanks very much.
I guess the process of allocation of budgets is a very complex exercise, and there's a science related to it, but there's a whole political economy in terms of how your decisions are made. And so our presentation relates to some of the science, which is about then how does it get used in the decision making. The three questions, firstly, MP Just, I was being opportunistic because I only coined this term this week, and I thought there's such traction related to the first 1,000 days of a child's life to for health services and how important that is. And so as we were playing around this, and I suppose it gives you an indication of how passionate we are about early learning, but this is now institutional learning, because the learning starts at home. And so if we take 5 years of the 2 years of pre-grade one and 200 days per school year, it sounded catchy. And I'm very glad at least somebody picked up on that. We will try to, the slogans and the awareness, and it helps in terms of raising the public awareness as well of the role of the early years of learning, because everything depends on it. So this was very much taking our own research and all our research showing how early learning outcomes affects all the future kind of learning and labor markets and the work of Heckman, etc., but in our own research. So that's where it came from. So that's the first one. The second one, looking at the compensation of teachers, and again, compensation of teachers is always a very emotional issue and a debate, and so this was presenting the findings that's there. I think in the 90s, or so early 90s, 80s, 94% of the budget was on salaries, so at least we've moved from 94 to 78. And it's important, again, that as we analyze the salary, it has to be done in relation to something else. I mean, we can't just say 78, is that good or bad? And therefore, I thought, and I have some of the slides here, that if we look at it in relation to other countries, of course we would like to be like Hungary or somebody else, and of course the ideal would be less, but if you're going to grow the fiscus, then somebody's got to pay the taxes and somebody's got to do. So it's very difficult, recognizing the difficulty of the decisions of 28.3% of resources to deal with historical backlogs, to deal with sorting out the school infrastructure. And I think yesterday or the day before, Minister Mocheka in her speech, talked about the education budgets, the youth slash, and the concerns of dealing with meeting the infrastructure needs. So of course, rather you guys than us that deal with the very difficult questions of which one you're going to make, and of course you can sort of say what is the risk of making it, and what are the, and sometimes the, I think for us in the education, the unintended consequence of the political decision, and which, no, nobody can argue that there should be fee-free university education, but the unintended consequence has been that some of the budget from infrastructure of education, schooling, has moved to higher education, the silence around grade R, and therefore it's going to be the constant cycle of trying to play catch-up. And that is not a very efficient system, but how are we going to ensure and commit to the earlier years? So it was more in that, and in terms of that, of course the questions can be asked if it's, and therefore the continued question about the quality of the achievement outcomes. I'm saying we're paying 78%, and there needs to be the constant debate in the country that screams for higher quality education, that screams, that's saying there's a change and the pace is too slow, and trying to find those leverage points. To the question about preschool and rural education, in our analysis, I think we're making the plea that at the moment grade R is not compulsory. It's not legislated as compulsory. And so if it is, we aspire to, or the statement says we're aspiring towards universal grade R education, but if grade 1 to 9 is compulsory, grade R is not compulsory. And
sure. Schools will always say it's compulsory for your child to be admitted at grade 1 with the report from the preschool. And this has been going on for years. It's not like today. It's been going on for years.
The practices of what's happening, I think it's looking at that if, and the grade, at the grade R level, because the legislation and the budget, and so the conditions, some schools, some public schools have a grade R classroom attached to them, but not all of them. In terms of trying to, for example, the big question now is the salaries of grade R teachers, and the tension around that they don't have the same salaries, they don't have the same conditions of service as teachers that are in grade one, in the other part of the schooling. And so we need to raise the status of the grade R sector, both in terms of the legislation, in terms of the conditions and the budget that goes to grade R, the conditions for the teachers, and the more training of those teachers. And so that was the point. I absolutely agree with you that what happens in rural grade R classes and the questions around firstly the availability and the questions. Now, at the macro level, we know about 60% of kids that go to grade 1 would have been at an institutional grade R. So as I said, the point of it was about compulsory as in legislation and budgets then allocated in legislation and therefore government being held accountable for what happens in that grade R classroom. At the moment, grade RR happens, but in more the, again, it's not a compulsory part of it, but middle-class households would send children to grade RR, and there's a more structured learning in that process. And so, and as the NDP says, you know, it's 2 years grade one. So again, it's our argument in terms of institutional arrangements that grade RR and grade, especially for the no-fee learners that go to no-fee schools, should be made compulsory with the concomitant budgets and all the, and the accountabilities, etc. So that was the kind of point, and I know that if we haven't had universal and the budgets for grade R and the whole cost and this, all of it, but we must aspire towards that. That was the point of it.
So I wanted to say I'm really glad I had breakfast this morning. I didn't know I was coming for a pummeling from Parliament, so I'm feeling I'm glad I fortified myself so I can respond to the really strong statements. I thought we were coming to share information. So I want to say a couple of things in response in that spirit of conversation between the HSRC and esteemed members of Parliament in this committee. And I think that, you know, as I wiped the blood off my face from the first comment, I was thinking, well, after that body blow, is there something we should be hearing from the comment? And I think there is something there. I think there's something about trying to get the balance right in terms of how we do the presentation. We've gone through many ways in which we've done this over the years. We focus on our work. And then you're sitting feeling like, oh, that's all about your work, but how are you helping us make these important decisions about the budget? And so I think, as Dr. Reddy was saying, we're trying to get the balance right in the sense of, because of our research, because we know these areas so well, we try and respond to them so that we give you some things to think about, and in doing that response, we do comment on our work, but we don't focus on it in the way in which I think was being asked by the first comment. And it's something we need to think about as we go away from the HSRC. And I want to make 4 points in response to what you've raised this morning. I think certainly supporting the plug for the first 1,000 days, the first 1,000 days of schooling, as my colleague has done. But I think also overwhelming and strong evidence about early childhood development and how important that is. So that's from 0 to 8 and the importance of interventions for children, for parents, for caregivers. Lots and lots of data supporting the need for us investing in those early, early years, giving children a better start, and hopefully if we do that, we can kind of turn around some of those adverse effects and consequences we see later on in their lives. Now, all of my work has been in rural KwaZulu-Natal, so all of the research I speak about is based on that rural context that I come from. We spent a lot of time doing work on, for example, HIV/AIDS, as my colleague Professor Zuma will speak about just now, the gains and responses on mother-to-child transmission have been phenomenal. Less than 2% in the country, we've really turned that around, and the HSRC has been leading in a lot of that work. Issues of children being overweight always get a kind of emotional response because we feel that as parents we're doing a bad job. Or someone saying that as parents we're doing a bad job. And I think it's not a personal attack. It's not a personal thing. I think it points to exactly what you're saying, which are the broader structural issues that drive this. Why do we have obesity as a problem in rural communities? So the data I showed you is in rural KwaZulu-Natal. That's where it comes from. Why do we have a problem with obesity? Why do we have a problem with stunting? That is because of the structural conditions of children's lives, of men's lives, of poor black families that have not changed. The drivers are poverty. That's what it is. Children are getting filled. They're eating food that doesn't have good nutritional value. And that's what's leading to those particular problems. So when you think about early childhood development, when you think about schooling, I think the point we're wanting to make is we must look at these contextual factors. If we don't, we'll continue to see some of the problems that I think we're highlighting. There are really good examples, the speaker at the back, on how we can try and reverse these problems. Early breastfeeding, lots of data and success around that in our country and globally, the importance of good nutrition, reversing some of those outcomes. And doing the things that we did when we were younger, which is physical activity. We all talk about and bemoan the fact that many kids spend less and less of their time being physically active. Strong data on the importance of physical activity in really addressing some of those issues on obesity and stunting. So there are interventions, there are programs, there are things that are working. And maybe just the last comment from the tertiary education about if you're black and poor, life is really hard on you. That was a comment from a young African black a student who was talking about, again, those contextual issues in education, that you might find a way and get to university, but when you get there, there's a whole range of things that you're fighting against, that struggle to get access, the fact that many of those kids have poor nutrition. They don't have enough to kind of survive on as they are trying to learn and trying to grow and trying to get an education for themselves. So that was a comment from a young African black student commenting on that. And then just the last comment on just some of the work we have done in rural communities to improve access. I absolutely agree with you. One of the big issues around access is we expect people who have very little resources, time, to go to facilities which are often far away from them. And a lot of the work has been on looking at community-based strategies for delivery. How do you take counseling and testing services? How do you take antiretroviral treatment closer to where people are? So we've got caravans, we've got mobile staff, we move around door to door to try and get those services to people. It's a lot of work on community-based delivery of testing, of treatment, of NCD screening as a way of getting closer to people and getting the services that they need.
Thank you, Chairperson. The strides that the country has made around HIV and the contribution that HSRC as an institution has made to understand issues around HIV, TB, and other non-communicable diseases, I mean, there's a lot of information available out there to that effect. Now, the issue around which epidemic is leading the other epidemic between HIV and other non-communicable diseases, I think we need to understand these diseases, that these are epidemics that we face as a society, and none of them is more important than the other, and we need to put our efforts on both of them. However, I have to say that with the non-communicable diseases, they are actually becoming a bigger problem as we speak. As I mentioned earlier on, if you look at the cause of death, for example, in the report, diabetes is actually going high up. It's listed among the top five now. And one of the issues that we are succeeding in reducing mortality around HIV because of the wide access to antiretroviral treatment, but we're not doing as much on other non-communicable diseases, and that is the point that we're making there, that we need to invest, not at the expense of another, but we need to invest a lot also on other non-communicable diseases. It is becoming a big problem. The more people, the more we win the epidemic of HIV, there are other issues that seems to have been neglected, and we need to put a lot of efforts around them. Now, about the statistics that we're talking about there, whether they include mining communities or not, these are very big surveys that we spoke about there, like, for example, an HIV prevalence survey, which is targeting 60,000 people. These are household-based surveys that are nationally representative, and nothing bigger than that one can get in a population-based survey. And these surveys indeed include everyone who lives within the borders of South Africa, including people that would be in the mining communities. But of course, these are not, for example, specific studies focusing on mining communities, but these are population-based surveys that include everyone, including people that are working in the mining communities. And the information, for example, about TB will actually be presented in the early 2019. That information, we're busy collecting data at the moment, and that information will be available. Around the one of HIV prevalence survey, we estimate that in June we'll be having presenting new statistics about HIV prevalence in the country and the numbers of people that are on ARVs and the numbers of people that are virally suppressed. I said June because I'm so eager to get this information out there. But we'll be presenting that information, and it's massive information that should be coming out. The issues around mother-to-child transmission of HIV, these are the challenges that we face. And the statistics indeed do show that we've made great strides, but obviously we're not there yet. We're winning, we're in the right direction to deal with the HIV epidemic in all angles, but we're not there yet. There's still a lot that needs to be done if we are to win the HIV, the fight against the HIV epidemic. Thank you, Chairperson.
Honourable members, are there follow-up questions? All right, there's a follow-up question by Honourable Member Paulson. Follow-up question by Honourable Member. And please, this time, must ask a question. Honourable Member Mendir. And then follow-up question by Honourable Member Snukwanyane and Honourable Member Wabaza. In that order. Short and to the point, we have another presentation after this one.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and good morning. Good morning to the members of the HSRC. The HIV program is the largest program in the Department of Health. So in terms of the experience here, are we seeing a reduction in HIV cases? That would give us an idea as to how successful this program is. And then on page 21, we speak about the expenditure on education, and it's all good and well to spend more money. But in terms of international standards, our grade fours are some of the, you know, is ranks the lowest. Really, in 80 countries, our grade fours, their levels of literacy and numeracy is the lowest. So we need to understand also, I have an idea or, you know, a hunch that a lot of, if one also looks at nutrition in terms of the high levels of poverty. We've got 8.2 million people who do not have access or whose nutrition does not meet the daily requirement. So I want to know if the HSRC has looked at the correlation between the low levels of literacy and numeracy, and also what role nutrition plays in all of that, so that we have an idea as to where we should focus on, and also we can start looking at the impact of any intervention in that. Thank you very much, and good morning, Professor Sardin.
You are forgiven for coming late. Thank you very much, Honourable Member Nia.
Chairperson, I mean, I'm really sorry that the delegation seem aggrieved, but I would not have raised the question that I raised had it not been for the weak presentation. I mean, if you look at slide 11, for example, there's some very good and pertinent questions, but there are no answers. Equally, if you look at slide 30, that sentence, how do we create the cry around the first 1,000 days of schooling? I mean, not only is it inaccurate, it's a sentence that would raise a question in a first-year essay. So I think there is something the HSRC needs to hear, and that is, or they need to ask themselves a question. If their objective is to seriously influence the budget process, is this really the best that you can do, given that you are the premier state-funded research institution in South Africa, costing the taxpayer 573 million rand this year? And frankly, my view is, if you can't get your act together, we'll close you down.
Okay, you did not make it better.
Yeah, but also maybe if I could also bring this, the other side of the coin. The other side of the coin is, this committee, in compliance with King 4 report, identified key stakeholders that it would like to partner with in the analysis of the appropriations bill. But also you must remember, even in the analysis of the appropriations bill, we then thought we should be assisted to look at the bill from a broader perspective, and also allowing for both internal and external influences so that we can do quality work and make an impact as this committee. So it is not by mistake that you were invited to come here. But I would like to apologize on behalf of Mr. Menier and on behalf of the committee, because you came here out of our own design. And we actually indicated the areas where we wanted you to assist us with. You're not the only key stakeholder. There are many other stakeholders. And we anticipated that you would also bring your perspective. So you have brought your perspective in as far as the analysis is concerned. But we thank you very much for the work that you have done. And in my opening remarks, I have also alluded to the fact that, alluded to how you have assisted us to also craft the recommendations with regard to the appropriations bill to the House. Because remember, after this, we don't take everything as is, but we use this information to influence our thinking on how best we think this. And then one of our other tasks is to amend. So as you talk to us, you pump this information, and we look at this. This information, any information is of good use. Any information. If not today, you can even use it tomorrow. You can even use it, you know. For instance, when I looked at this, I even saw the need to share it with those committees, those votes that are, it's information. So I'm trying to say, please don't feel discouraged. You will remain our key stakeholder until maybe I decide that this stakeholder is not helping us. For now, we feel helped. So continue assisting us. But maybe what Mr. Menier wanted to see is figures, because you must remember, other people, we express ourselves in different, this is a narrative, maybe you wanted to see figures, but maybe you should then say, in future, we'll appreciate if you can also show us figures, you know? So, because it's still a way of communicating, narrative or in the form of figures, you know? So I think, yeah, that's it, but please, you must know, you remain our key stakeholder. Thank you very much. The next, sorry that I had to come in and put this, because there was emphasis on, at first I thought maybe if I don't talk about it, it will die. But then I realized it's not dying. Yeah. Everybody has got the freedom to express himself, but we must also, this is a stakeholder. We must make good use of the stakeholders that we call here. All right, thanks. Shall we then have the next person making a follow-up question? But you also allowed if you've got a new question. But this is the last round. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. I just would like to speak to that slide number 9, just generally. I've just noted a few things where you said we could set some criteria and all that, but I would like to just say, without actually assisting Honorable Romania, because I think he was also speaking to that one, but just to say that, in terms of that, you know, there is a whole process. Ours is to exercise oversight when everything is done and all. And if you remember, we had the budget in tables, we had the division of revenue, and then we are now at the level of the appropriations bill, and we exercise oversight. So many people are involved, the Department of Treasury in particular, to be specific, and then we have SCOPA also, you know, everybody is there. Just to say that some of these things we do not necessarily have to do ourselves, but we need to exercise oversight. And then in terms of departmental priorities, they will come with their, the departments will come with that. We cannot determine them for them. They come with them, and then, of course, when it comes to the budget appropriation, then that is when we come in, after the minister has tabled the budget. So I thought I should just speak to that. And then in terms of the NSFAS funding for students, I'm really shocked to say the least that there are students that are funded for so many years. I've always thought that there is a limit to the number of years, but from what I've seen here, it's totally new, and I think it's very useful information that we are able to identify such a, it's a huge problem if they can be a student that can be funded for so many years, even though it's been decreasing. Even two students are too many. It's a, 9 years really, when other students do not get anything. I think I'm mentioning that by way of noting it or making an observation. But I think now that the NSFAS funding is going to be converted into a better, that perhaps we need to put in some elements in the whole allocation of this fund, as perhaps limiting the number of years. And sometimes you also wonder if some of these students are failing like this. But if you are getting the NSFAS, you are unlike poor students who do not get any funding. So again, it's just really by way of making an observation that obviously we need to put some systems in place, because I don't think we can be able to afford to pay for so many years. I mean, 4 years for me would be maximum, unless we do medicine or something like that. Thank you.
Let me go to slide 13. The last bullet of slide 13 on special zones and strategic projects. That it has been largely driven by the DTI, probably with the collaboration of economic development as well. I get the sense that you are suggesting that there is room for participation of all other departments in an effort to contribute to economic growth. And obviously, if that is the case, a more integrated planning and implementation thereof is that what are we reading you correctly in that? Secondly, slide 15. You know, you raise a very important issue about challenges of traditional governance and democratic governance. In a layman's language, one would say that the two, traditional leadership and local municipal municipalities, councillors and so on, are bound by largely two things. First is the delivery of social services, and the second is local economic development. It is not quite, I don't know whether you've had a closer look at what exactly are the causes of tensions between these two, if the two are bound largely by these two activities. Is it a contestation of who does what? Is it a contestation of undermining each other's authority? And therefore causing the local communities to suffer in the process. But I think we need to get to the real problem between the two structures. Maybe there was an initial failure in terms of integrating the two forms of governance coexisting. Perhaps if you could expand on that, so that we better understand this challenge, so that it can be tackled. The last one, Chairperson, is slide 19, read together with, I think, slide 28.
makes reference to higher education as well as basic education. Let me just quickly find these two slides without wasting too much of your time, Jefferson. On slide 19, you, and I think in one or two other sentences, you're making references to certain conditions for access to fee-free tertiary education. Any thoughts about any detail about these conditions? I hear my colleague Honorable Snokwanyana here mentioning one of those to say that maybe students must be alerted to the fact that the maximum of 4 years would be allowable, so that you avoid those who want to be perpetual students, like the 15 years of those who continue to receive grants and so on. But perhaps we need a little more detail on that in terms of just suggestions of what would be conditions. Now, on the same slide, with regard to basic education, I say that we read that together with slide, where did I see that? Slide 28, yes. Because you make some interesting proposals, in my view, in slide 28. We've been plagued by this issue of learners not able to read, probably write and count in the primary school sector. And I would like to understand, because the basis of all learning is exactly those three things, reading, writing, and counting. And that takes you off the learning experience. If those three are lacking right at the beginning, then you are as good as dead. So what have been the challenges in focusing our attention just to these three critical basic things that need to be done? Is it the issue of curriculum? Is it the issue of focus? Is it the issue of resources? Is it a combination of all of these things? What exactly, and how should we turn this around? Because it's a real worry. Because this affects later learning, and it's been going on for some time now. Thank you.
Actually, on the last one, I think I'm happy they raised it. Now it's up to us now to follow up with those relevant departments to check on how indeed they are using the budget to strengthen our children's learning in their 1,000. I learned today for the first time about the 1,000 days. we always learn when we meet. There's no way in which you can leave us the same when you leave this place. Now I want you to know that. So I think, it's good that you brought up these questions. These questions are not only for today. As I said to you, information will always be of use. Somebody taught me that. So as we continue with our quarterly interactions with the departments, so we will be using these questions to get, also to influence change in those areas where we would like to see change and make an impact, positive impact for that matter. Okay, thank you very much. Who else wanted to do a follow-up? So that's all, eh? Okay.
Mine is just one question. Would you say this deal is helping the country to achieve on its NDP goals? Remember, we say we are a developmental country and we are at a developing stage. So when you look at this budget as it is, regardless of the low economic environment in which it was crafted, or the budget was worked out, also regarded of the budgetary constraints we are confronted with, would you say it is still taking us there because we want to go there? We want to develop. Indeed, we want the economy to grow. The emphasis came from Professor here to say the only answer is economic growth. But what are we doing, all of us, to make sure that we achieve on that so that we can then liberate or offset all this poverty, this unemployment, high unemployment rate, and the inequality that we're still experiencing. The inequality part is even worse. Where we expected it to narrow, it's growing, the gap is growing bigger and bigger every day. But what is it that we need to do using this budget to narrow that gap? All right, we'll now hand over to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. So just one correction to Mr. Mania. We don't receive 507 million rands from the parliamentary grant. It's only 320 million. We raise the rest. It's talking about our whole budget, and that's what our budget is. We raise the rest of that money ourselves, Chairperson. I'm going to ask my colleagues to come into... I'd like to ask Professor Turok to kick us off, but I just want to answer the question that Honourable Member Kabasa raised about what's the issue with these questions around literacy, numeracy, and the ability to count. And the big, I think, reality that we're having to confront here is that we're still dealing with an inherited policy around mother tongue education. And that's the big question. I mean, how do we deal with children being able to learn in their mother tongues? And we've not resolved that question sufficiently in the country. That's the big learning breakdown that is happening, which we are having to pay a great deal of attention to. And there's a lot of work which is being done. We are doing work in this particular area around cognitive capacity in those first few years and how these young people are dealing with this challenge of cognitively engaging with concepts as they are seeing them. And just this process of what's happening in their brains is a really important area for future work. So it has major implications down the track. But I'd like to ask Professor Turok to lead us in your big question, Chairperson, and to put the other questions into perspective. Thanks.
Thanks very much. It's a very, very important and very difficult question, of course. Is the budget helping with the NDP? So I think my simple answer is yes and no. Yes, in terms of broad priorities, I think the government is committed, and the budget bears this out, to addressing poverty, to addressing the worst symptoms of poverty, to try to alleviate poverty, to try and promote redress. We see that with free fees. I think there is a general consensus that higher education is very important for mobility and for the labor market of the 21st century. We do need to widen access. We do need to transform who gets to university and so on. There's a limit to what the budget itself can do. It's only the spending, right? And I think that's the key point I want to make, that it requires government as a whole to be on the same page. It requires this whole society to be on the same page. This was a key message of the NDP. Government itself can't address the damaging history that we've inherited, right, from
from the past, apartheid and colonialism, right? This had led to serious, and hasn't been mentioned today, actually, I don't really think sufficiently, that we've inherited a really bad legacy of the past, and turning that around is a very, very difficult job. It requires society as a whole to find common cause wherever we can, rather than to find conflict and violence and disputes. We have to try and find common cause, and that's, as I said, it's partly government's responsibility. It's also a responsibility of other political leaders and of other stakeholders and other interests in society. And it's not straightforward, and it's a long haul, obviously. But I just wanted now quickly respond to the question from the honourable member there before I hand over. The question about these special initiatives. My third point, we haven't done a detailed evaluation of all of these initiatives, right? So that's a qualification to what I have to say. But so my understanding from monitoring what's happening at a fairly high level is that there is a difficult balancing act that government faces here, as in many other areas, between the political imperatives to do something, right, in poorer rural communities typically, and the economic, the harsh economic realities and the economic potential. And sometimes that balance, I'm raising questions about whether that balance is correct, because sometimes I think we do things dominated by the political imperatives to be seen to be doing something and don't take sufficient cognizance of the realities of ensuring that these investments are going to prove worthwhile. And it's understandable that balance is sometimes struck in the wrong way, but I think it is the job of Parliament, the job of the HSRC, to raise questions about that. And I, basically putting it simply, I think in some of these investments it will prove to be very difficult to attract private investment, because these are isolated places, they are not well connected in terms of the infrastructure of the country, to the markets that businesses need to serve, to the suppliers that businesses need for their inputs. And so there is a danger that, that basically we waste public resources.
Yeah, I want to respond on the, my name again is Barak Anyani. I want to respond on the issue of the relationship between traditional leaders and local government. And I think you rightly put there's a tension there, and I think more attention needs to be brought into perspective. The critical issue which I think we are wrestling in the local government space is the two institutions, traditional leadership and local government. What becomes a bit uncomforting, especially with the traditional leaders, is that the role of traditional leaders is not clarified in the constitution. But when you go to the local government as an institution, it is properly clarified that its role provides services in the communities. And as a result, there is an overlap of some of the activities that are happening. Traditional leaders often complain that they are not consulted when there are developmental activities happening, because they claim that they are the custodian of the community, especially the customary practices and development. But then the issue that still needs to be clarified is their roles, which happen often at times, and even brings a question about their relevance in the modern society. And these are the deep questions that are unfolding, because the question of undermining each other, it becomes very obvious because of their roles not being clarified. when this Municipal System Act and Municipal Structures Act demand the traditional leaders to be part of the meetings of the municipalities, but at the same time, the interplay of the power relations has become very pertinent to a point where service delivery gets frustrated. And I think we need to begin to clarify the role of traditional leaders to avoid this type of attention.
Thanks. Chairperson, you know, yesterday we did the presentation and our CEO said, you have 8 minutes to make your presentation, and it's through your questions that we could expand further. So we really apologize for racing through a set of slides because we needed the engagement. So we'll go a little bit further now in terms of your questions. Also to say that all that we've presented here does come from reports that we've been we've written, and so we could have reference to those reports. Honorable Paulson, I think it is, and you asked the question about the low levels of literacy and numeracy, and that's true. The Pearl study, which was released at the end of last year, of course presented the alarming figures about the levels of literacy that they measured at grade 4. Now, what we have taken a position, we also conduct the Trends in International Maths and Science study, and what the TIMSS gives further than the Pearls is A, it measures achievement, and it's true, our performance is on the lower end. But what we've used that because the methodology allows for trend and to measure how have we improved against ourselves over time. And so that's the only measure that we have in the country with a robust methodology and credible methodology to say this. So our assessment, having done them from 1995, 1999, 2003 to 2015, is that we started at a very low base. We've moved from very low to low. Now, of course, that doesn't look like an achievement, but we started very low. And so the assessment that we've made is that while there's been, and that's partly what I've presented before, that was that while that we've improved, the pace is very slow. And so the question then is to find those leverage points. And of course, it would be wonderful if we have an educational injection. And so if we use a biomedical model, and so does this vaccination work, and we can do this there. And so with all the complexities, there isn't one thing that says, if you do this, this is going to happen. We can sort of estimate what are possible changes and particular social context. So the question is true that the performance is low, but we've moved from very low to low, and the pace of change is slow. The link between literacy and numeracy and health issues, of course, those are there, or nutritional issues. Now, our assessment, looking at the different budgets, the number of social protection measures, and government, I think, has done reasonably well there. The 75% of our children receive school meals, which sort of supplements what's happening at home. And the Prof. Zuma and Sambaya will tell you from the Sam Haines, the South African Nutritional and Health Surveys, which will give you a better idea of the nutrition at the home. So we've done well in terms of no-fee schools. We've done better. I mean, we've done better, in my assessment, Ivan, done better on provision of no-fee schools, 66% of it, nutrition, learner transport, the health for under five, etc. Our challenge is to move to the next step with regard to education of what is it that's quality education with better, how does that cognitive, how do we move from that physical bit to getting that cognitive? And that is the elusive question that people around the world are trying to grapple with, and any kind, and we're all trying to grapple, and it happens in an incremental way. There's nothing that shows that it happens very fast. So that cognitive development, and which, you know, the proposal that we're putting forward, and others might put other places and say, invest in higher education and you have more human capital development, which then can feed into the system, is that you invest in the earlier years of learning. And this slide, Honourable MP that asked the question about slide 26, what we wanted to illustrate here, the same one that we had on the...
Oh,
sorry. When we undertook the TIMS study, for the first time we surveyed 12,000 parents to understand what's happening in the home. And we asked them these questions. So this slide tells you what are parents saying, the kind of school readiness of children, the readiness of children to enter school. Now, A, you can see from being able to play word games or counting or reading books, it is low. But also what it shows is that those children that come from no-fee schools, the lack of home activities understandably is far less. And so the question then becomes, how does the state intervene to, this set of... Middle-class kids have a different set of things, and we can look at the middle-class activities. We know what it is. We know what happens. The kids from the poorer, lowest SES households have a different reality, and so the question is then, how does the state intervene to try to ameliorate for that? And so therefore, and again, we've got papers that have been written here saying, for public no-fee schools, if one wants to invest more in grade RR, the starting point is public no-fee schools. They need it more. Middle class will find different ways of trying to get this going. So that's there. I also want to point out a study that the HSRC contributed to. There were three studies from the HSRC to the high-level panel that was instigated by Parliament, and we did this study on skills development. And again, it's a 300-pager that we've contributed, or 200-pager, to make an argument of the change in legislation that will move towards reduction of poverty, inequality, and unemployment. Ivan Turok's spatial development, and Nania Bola on gender. So there are, the reports are there. On the NSFAS funding, again, it comes from a study which commissioned by NSFAS itself. And so they will release the study soon, so I'm giving you an early kind of look into the study. So, and it's a report which gives you all the aspects there. So I think the point of showing that how kids, also rather, we analyze the NSFAS database. That was the point of data, all the recipients, and that's where we found that people received these grants and the rest of it. I think Minister Pandor has indicated towards conditionality with regard to those bursaries there, and the conditionality related to success in passing through the system. I mean, the other conditionality might just be making sure the IT system has something which says, and I think it was a surprise for NSFAS to see as well that you've got these grants, because if people move to different institutions and you reapply for it, but so Minister Pandor's kind of conditionality about you can't, spend 5 years in first year, assume it will relate to success rates on those grants that are there. I think you asked about reading, writing, and counting, and of course we're all grappling with that question. You know, oftentimes we focus on the outcomes, and we know what kids should have achieved, that, and then the curriculum says that. But our starting point is not the same line. And so our starting point is very different. And so this notion about the starting point and recognizing the difference in the starting point, and then how does the state intervene in terms of that? And so all we can say is that it's still a massive concern, and it is going to be a massive concern for a while yet before we can reach the levels of education that we are comfortable about in the country. And so the Department of Basic Education, for example, now only in 2013 set a curriculum for grade R on what is it that they expect before that, as part of the process, it was more play centers and creches, etc. But now, at least there's a curriculum that teachers can, those grade R teachers can follow to actually have achieve that. I think if I had to expand further, I would say
that in terms of the investment, those grade R classes mustn't be more than 20 kids in a class. I mean, you can't have 60 kids and 50 kids in a classroom and have proper engagement. So it's about those kinds of norms that we need to set into place for what would be meaningful education at the lower end of the spectrum.
That was a marathon of an engagement. Yeah, no, but thank you so much. It's information. And us tapping from your wealth of knowledge. Because sitting here, I know that you spoke about professors. So it's an added advantage because we are learning as we are working from professors. Indeed, we really appreciate. And do you want to say something? Do you want to say something? But because I see your lighting.
I was going to respond on the issue of HIV.
Also, there's something. Okay, so we're not done.
Right. So,
this is the last one.
Okay,
no, also
gently
moving towards
closure.
Okay, no, that's fine.
Okay, thank you, Honourable Chairperson. Well, indeed, I indicated earlier on that you know, the government has to be commended for the contribution that has been made around funding HIV, and also the issue whether we're being successful around the areas of HIV. I have to say, like I indicated earlier, that we have made strides to win the fight against the HIV epidemic. However, we are not where we're supposed to be or where we would have loved to be. For example, the HIV incidence, which is the rate at which people get infected with HIV, it is going down. We've seen that, and the numbers are showing that. Even the latest modeling work that has been done by our colleagues, the Tembisa model, for example, has shown that the incidence of HIV is going down around 1.2%, for example. However, it's not where we want it to be. And looking at the HIV-related mortality, it has gone down. People are living longer, which is, again, good. But we're not winning it, especially among young, the youth, the 15 to 24-year-olds, and more so among young girls, where the prevalence still continues to increase, and that increase is not necessarily because they are living longer due to access to antiretroviral treatment, but it's because of the increased incidence, which means there are still a lot of new infections that are coming into that age group, and that is one of the areas that we need to pay particular attention to. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Honorable members, it's clear that we have now come to the end of our engagement, and I will then request Professor to give us your closing statement.
Thank you very much. Despite what you might think, Chairperson, we enjoy coming here. We'd like to think that this mandate which we have been given to be doing work which is in the interest of the public good is the commitment that we are demonstrating here. All our work is about addressing these problems and these difficulties. We're not able to deal with the full spectrum of the country's challenges and so on simply because of capacity and funding, but we'd like to think that the work that we do has been prioritized sufficiently to be able to get us to the heart of what these challenges are. So it is a matter of commitment for us to come here. We come here not because you simply asked us. We come here because we think that we have something to say, which will be of value to thinking about the solutions that the country needs to be taking up. So we appreciate this opportunity, Chairperson, and we're sorry that we don't always satisfy.
Satisfy
particular people's anxieties, but it is our intention and desire to make a contribution. So thank you very much, Chairperson. We look forward to coming back here repeatedly. Thank you.
Okay. Honourable members, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for this participative meeting. I would like to thank the HSRC for coming, your preparations, and coming all the way to empower us with knowledge. And I would also like to thank the honourable members for your quality inputs in this engagement. The Human Science Research Council's inputs are most valued and will assist us as we finalize our reports, because this engagement is a build-up towards a compilation of a report with recommendations to the House. And as we've already put it to you, we're not only listening to your story, FFC also came before us. There are a few key stakeholders that we have identified, and all of you indeed are assisting us to be able to look at and analyze the budget also from a broader perspective and apply maximum objectivity in our work. The budget is one of the most important policy tools, the one that provides financial means to implement government policies, because all of us sitting here, we know that government has got good policies but limited resources. But then we have a PFMA which says, can you try and do more with less? So you are assisting us to say, with this less, how can we then align the budget in such a way that we make the impact that we all would like to see, that of bringing a quality life, not for only one person, for all. Quality life for all. The budget needs all of us and needs a wide range of views and quality inputs in order that this committee recommends a budget that is transformative, that drives growth and development in a manner that best serves all South African citizens. Prof, you correctly said that we come from a damaging history, but that's something of the past. We have the present. And it needs all of us, you know, to put our hands on deck to try and bring about this change so that all South African citizens live a quality life. So these HSRC inputs on early childhood development, on the interface between municipalities and traditional authorities, I thought this one came up strong, on streamlining and deepening public participation in major development projects, ensuring effectiveness in healthcare, improving completion rates in higher education, those throughputs, you know, increasing the throughputs so that there is value for money. For now, whilst a lot of money is pumped in, it came out from our engagement, a lot of money is pumped in to the PSET, is the post-school education and training, the throughputs are not matching the budget that is being pumped in. So I'm talking about what came out from your inputs, May, and then improving completion rates, okay, I've done that, and NSFAS monitoring systems and other issues. Ours, as this committee, is to monitor these issues as we interrogate and conduct oversight over the budget allocation and spending and over department service delivery performance. Now, we've been asking ourselves questions, what is it that we're not doing, because, I mean, we are doing oversight function. But as you talk to us, you're also actually talking sense into, look at these other areas. But maybe, for instance, if we can then say 1,000, everybody talks about 1,000, I promise you, people will plan for 1,000. It's like anyone who comes into office, like a politician comes over, they'll give you 100 days. And I promise you, within, because there's time rate, within that 100 days, oh, you must see, something comes out. So now we must say 1,000 so that they can see that we're measuring. And then we'll be following on whether we are achieving within this, what we want to achieve within this 1,000 days
for our children at the foundation stage. All right, thanks to the honorable members for their inputs, and also, when I say honorable members, I mean all of you for your inputs, and also for pushing the Human Science Research Council to dig deeper into the issues, as indeed the country faces difficult times and the budgeting is a complex exercise. And it should be a people-driven budget. Remember, a democratic government. So our core business is also public participation. That's our core business. So it's another way, you know, of involving even institutions within the broader community to come and talk to us. So we believe that indeed your coming here was not a waste of time, and we want to thank you so much for your time, and thank you, honorable members. I'm going to allow members 1 minute, 1 minute, no, 1 minute is not enough. 5 minutes human rights break, so that we, as we allow you to, you know, because we're done between the 12. Thank you so much, and let us travel safe back home. Thank you.
Honourable members, after